Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Well, as I mean, to us, you know, there's a whole chapter in my book dedicated to this particular topic of, you know, the thorny issue of how hackers interface with journalists and the sort of information warfare side of it. It was, as I won't lie to you, it was the hardest chapter of the book to write because, you know, this is very much my industry and having to take a step back and look in quite critical terms at my own industry of journalism was not an easy experience. Partly because in a lot of the rest of the parts of the book, you know, it's quite obvious who the bad guys were and what the dynamic was. Whereas with this, every time I sort of thought of an instance where I could see that something had gone wrong, I could see reasons why that same set of rules could be justified, you know, to use something to do something good. So, for example, anonymous whistleblowing, the idea of anonymity, you know, on the one hand, that leaves journalists, you know, fatally exposed to having their strings pulled by, in some cases, nation state hacking groups who are strategically leaking information to do nation state level damage. So, you know, you think, well, never believe anonymous sources, never take stuff from anonymous sources. On the other hand, anonymous sources gave us things like Watergate. So, you know, there's a long and illustrious history of journalists protecting their sources. So it was one of the chapters of the book that was more sort of discursive than a lot of the other chapters, because every time I thought of one instance, I could think of another instance that would justify those same set of conditions. So, and I have to say, I mean, in terms of, you know, what the objective is, you know, in an idealistic world, the objective of all this is truth. We all want to get the truth out. Frankly, I will be honest about this. For a lot of journalists at the moment, it's keeping our jobs. It's staying relevant. It's keeping in front of people and getting eyeballs and getting attention. And sometimes there are journalists for whom that's more important, perhaps, than the truth, or certainly more important in some cases than knowing where your data is coming from and who's pulling your strings. And for some of the data leakers and some of the people manipulating data and sending it to journalists or publishing it online, you know, they're not just getting the truth out. They're trying to make a name for themselves. They're trying to get, you know, kudos. They're trying to get celebrity status. So we're in this slightly murky field, and it's developing all the time. There's one final thing I'd say, which is, you know, in the book, I've sort of talked about hackers and journalists as being these two separate camps. You know, if you look at the work of people like Bellingcat, the investigative journalism website, increasingly they are, that two camps are starting to merge into one. You know, Bellingcat, I can't work out really whether it's hackers or journalists, and they're a bit of both is the truth of it. But I just find that whole new territory really, really interesting. So that's where I'm coming at from it.
Yep. And for those listening, you're hearing the voice of Jeff White. He's obviously coming to us from a journalistic perspective. And I'm gonna come back to him in a second so he can give us a little background on himself. But we also have joining us today, Jake Williams, also known as Malware Jake on Twitter. And Jake, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sean. Pleasure to be here.
And Jeff, thanks as well. I'm gonna kick it off. I think we have a good base there, Jeff. I'm gonna ask each of you to maybe just share a few words about what you're up to and your role and your interest in this topic of collaboration and angst between researchers and journalism. So, Jake, just a few words about what you're up to and maybe a brief view into your past, because I think your world of intelligence has a direct impact on this conversation.
Well, sure. Yeah, definitely. So I spent, I think as a lot of folks know, I spent 18 years in the intelligence community you know, ultimately left in 2013. So for 18 years, the press was the enemy. And now 2013 and beyond, right? You know, now we have the now, of course, you know, the press has kind of taken on a whole different angle for me. And of course, very interested in this topic for a lot of reasons. You know, in fact, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do from a research perspective, a lot of the breaches that we work end up getting covered in the press. And so there is a very, and obviously vulnerabilities discovered, et cetera. And so there's a very a symbiotic, I think, as Jeff was mentioning, a relationship between researchers and hackers, if you will, right? As well as the press. And so getting that relationship set correctly, I have a great interest in that, of course, because again, if we're looking for that not to be regulated, of course, regulating the press in the U.S. is a thorny subject, but in general, just even worldwide, if we don't want this to be regulated, if we don't want folks to take a negative opinion of that, it's on us in the community to get that right.
I agree. And Jeff, I'd like to get a bit about what you've been up to and some of the things you've worked on. That this conversation, in fairness, was inspired by a presentation you gave at Black Hat Europe, London, I believe it was 2019. I was hoping to be there for that, but I didn't make it. But yeah, a little background for yourself, so folks know what perspective you're bringing.
Yeah, sure. So I've been a journalist most of my adult life, and I've worked for sort of various outlets, notably Channel 4 News in the UK, BBC News, the Sunday Times, and I published a book last year called Crime.com, which is basically everything you need to know about cybercrime, but we're afraid to ask. And in terms of the stuff that I've worked on, what's been interesting is there's been this really interesting trajectory. I've worked on every big tech story that came our way, from the sort of anonymous hacks through Ashley Madison, through Sony, through WannaCry, the Snowden leaks. We did a significant amount on the Snowden leaks, right up through Cambridge Analytica and sort of recent data scandals. So one of the great things about writing a book was being able to sort of step back and take a bit of a broader view of all that stuff. And that was one of the things I tried to do with the talk at DEF CON, as I say, in 2019, was to sort of say, look, there is a relationship between journalists and hackers. And I'll use the hacker term quite broadly. I mean, it's also data leakers, data manipulators, data traders, and so on. And it sort of doesn't get discussed a lot. It's still a bit of a niche sport, a bit of a fringe sport, I think, among journalists, this interaction. But increasingly, some of the really big scoops that we've had have come from connections between journalists and techies, Snowden being a perfect, example. And so I wanted to open it up. And I have to say, I mean, that DEF CON presentation was, I really felt like I was putting my head in the lion's mouth there, because this is a room full of people who really, really know their stuff, probably have a view of journalists, almost certainly have a view of journalists and how we cover hackers and a new industry. So it really felt like kind of getting on stage and just thinking, how many bricks am I going to get thrown at me? The audience were very kind, I will say, but it was I was just interested. I put it out there. It's one of these things, you put a talk out there and you just say, okay, how's this going to go? What's the feedback going to be? So that was where I came at it from it.
I know that well.
Good to hear. Thank you, Jake.
And definitely, I mean, everybody has an opinion of journalism, and I want to maybe start with this, Jeff, because you mentioned early on in this conversation that you didn't say clicks, right? But oftentimes publications, the main goal is to get eyeballs, get clicks, to drive views on ads. And I know Marco and I kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say struggled, but we made it a point to not cover the latest breach, because we didn't want to be the clickbait and the publication kind of trying to figure out what the truth is, what really happened. And so what I'm wondering from your perspective, Jeff, is how, because you said, well, how do we get, are we trying to get people to be aware and make their own decisions, or are we trying to, as journalists, make a decision for them and give them an answer? I guess is the question, because we in our podcast, we're always trying to get people to think and ask questions, not necessarily feed them the answer.
It's an interesting one. And I think you've got to put all this against the backdrop of what's happening in journalism, which again isn't necessarily something that the tech community would necessarily have a handle on, or should have a handle on, really. It's our thing to sort out. But we are competing as journalists with so much of the advertising revenue has gone to Facebook and Google. If you look at local newspapers in the US and in the UK, it's a disaster zone. If you look at how national media is responding, it's not good. I mean, there's a slight sense of an existential battle. So, when you're talking about the press and how we cover things, please bear in mind, we're not in a we're not in a great position. We're not the power brokers we once were. So bear in mind there's more going on than just how you feel about journalism. Journalism has its own battles to sort of fight at the moment. And it's a really good question you bring up in terms of, you know, do we basically tell people, do we try and sort of lead people in the coverage, or do we just let them make up their own minds? I think the one thing that I have trouble with is the slightly terrifying doom-laden sort of coverage of cybersecurity. And there's this constant sort of drumbeat of breach stories. And it's got to the point where even somebody like myself, you know, I get the breach alerts and so on, and I just look and think, God, but what does that one mean? Is that a cover? Should I cover that? Because if you tried to cover them all, it's just impossible. There's just too many. And it just gets to the point where people become blasé, they take it for granted. You know, X million records hacked from X company. What does that mean? Why should I care? And I think frankly, we've lost that battle. I think, you know, there was so much sort of fear-laden reporting around this stuff that I worry that we've lost the public because we're not telling them, and the ramification is this, and the consequence is this, and what you can do about it is this. So I think, I don't know whether that answers your question, but I think the missing bit of journalism sometimes is saying, is that answering that so what question? So what does this mean? So what do I do? So what's the bigger ramification? And, you know, a lot of that day-to-day breach reporting is just, you know, what was it? There was, I think, Motherboard or one of the publications had a thing, Another Day, Another Breach, which on the one hand was a great sort of, you know, tagline for a series of articles. On the other hand, it was depressing and it was off-putting. It's like another day, another breach, therefore it's not news. I was like, I'm not sure whether I would have gone for that, you know, that tagline for that set of articles. But
I guess I'll jump in. I was just going to enjoy the conversation, but I'm here. And when we talk about journalism, it's kind of like you know, kind of my background study as well. So I want to throw a couple of comments and then turn to Jake. Geoff, what you said about the problem is, in my opinion, is we're just covering the breaches. And I think that's a big problem for society, and it's a big problem for the hacking community that is doing a lot of good work and not just bad work, as is then advertised on the media. And I agree with you. It's all about the click. And of course, the bad news, it makes much more noise than the good one. But Jake, did you see any, let's say, improvement in lately on how this presentation of the hacking community is being on the news, and how we can all benefit from this relationship?
Sure. I guess a couple of thoughts there, right? One, to Geoff's point, without a doubt, right? There's definitely breach fatigue in reporting right now. So much so that, you know, if I roll back 2 years ago, right? So, and I'm rough timeline, but let's call it 2 years ago, in my incident response practice, if you had more than a few employees, it was a guarantee, that virtual guarantee, that your breach was making the news. Because at some point, you know, somebody internally was going to say something to somebody else who was going to post it on Facebook, and a reporter was going to pick it up, and then it was going to be news. And now I'm dealing with folks where ransomware gangs are releasing their data and there's no headline around it, right? And so, like, not even just not a headline. I just Googled two that we've worked in the last month where I know for a fact data has been released on, and just not making the news. That makes me happy in one regard, and kind of sad in another, right? But it definitely does illustrate the breach fatigue. Happy that, you know, of course, these are clients, right? So their stuff's not being laundered around the, you know, or their names not being sullied any more than it need be. And then on the other side, with this, I'm also seeing that, you know, that we have a lot of folks that, you know, are not benefiting from seeing that, you know, because every time somebody gets hit, the competitors of and others in the vertical say, oh my gosh, like we need to pay attention, kind of. And that's the good defensive security, right? And to that end, around the kind of that reporting, like how do you frame it? How do you make it matter to somebody? Because again, if it is really another day, another breach, then why does it matter? I guess I'll also say that, you know, another thing I've noticed over the last couple of years trending, right, is less stigma around the term hacker, less stigma around the security researchers, you know, particularly in the press. You know, there are some that we could call out that do it really poorly. Most, I would say, you know, in the media are doing a much better job of not vilifying, I guess, hacking and security work overall. So I guess there's always going to be that complex relationship, but I think it net positive gain over the last couple of years, with the exception of course, again, you know, a lot of the breach reporting, we just have too much of it, and we've gotten numb to it.
Yeah. And Jeff, let's talk a little bit about the content of what we're reporting on. What I've seen, and obviously in the US, there's the SolarWinds breaches of late, and we constantly see people jumping in from all walks of life with their, I'll have to say, opinion, unless either of you correct me otherwise, with their views on what happened and how it happened, why it happened, and who it happened by. And so I'm wondering if that noise, in one regard, it helps raise awareness, but in two, it's like, oh my God, the sky is falling, but there's nowhere to hide.
Right. Yeah.
So, are there any nuggets in those types of reportings, and are those helpful in any way?
It's interesting. So I, one of the things, when I was writing the book, you obviously have to do an end chapter, an epilogue, and it has to be sort of, you know, witty and pithy and stuff. I just hated it. I just wanted to end it with, and that's it. I wanted the final chapter to be, that's it, so we're done. But you have to come up with some sort of pithy sum up. So I was sitting at my desk, and there was a bus went past with an advert for the Godzilla movie, which was being released at the time. I just thought, well, it's Godzilla. It's an interesting analogy, because like Godzilla comes out of the ocean and he smashes buildings and puts cars in his mouth, and then he crashes back into the waves and he's gone. You know, I sort of thought, well, that's kind of our coverage of cybersecurity. You know, hackers have come out and they've stolen credit cards and crashed a company. Who are they? We don't know. They're gone. And it just struck me as very unhelpful long term, because there's this idea of, you know, we never know where the monsters are from. There's no rhyme or reason to it. And, you know, if you look generally, there is a rhyme and reason to it. You know, ransomware is, as Jake's pointed out, you know, ransomware is the perfect and almost the most evolved cybercrime creature we've seen. And it's come from somewhere. It came from bank hacking gangs, mainly in Russia. It's evolved through Bitcoin. So it's got a payment mechanism. The hackers don't lose any of their take to middlemen. There's no laundering thing. You know, there's dynamics behind ransomware that explain why that Godzilla monster sort of comes out at us. I just sort of think, you know, for the general public, we've got to put those explanations in front of them, and not just, we've got to be the kind of Jeff Goldblum scientist in the sci-fi movie who says, well, you know, the reason the monster is coming now is because of this, you know. And I mean, the SolarWinds thing was really interesting, because I know it was big. I know big organizations got affected, very important organizations got affected, and there's attribution around who did it and so on. But I just thought, for a lot of the people who, you know, if that's the headline, the cybersecurity headline, A, you've got to explain how the SolarWinds hack worked, which I still think is really interesting. I don't think that's actually necessarily been fully told. B, what the effect is, who got hit, what they lost, what the ramification is. And C, most importantly, how does that affect anybody? You know, it, beyond just being a big geopolitical incident, you've really got to work to say, look, this is the ramification. And so I found that a really interesting incident, in that it had the feeling of bigness and the reporting of bigness. But when you actually looked at it, you're like, well, why is this big? And I, in the reporting I read, no one really nailed it to me as to why this is big and why this is important. I'm starting to get that now from contacts I'm chatting to. But yeah, I thought the SolarWinds one was a really interesting one.
You know what I think? And then, Jack, I'm going to leave it to you. There was a joke on a certain point that if you play Godzilla reverse, it's just a good monster that fixed the city and then goes back quietly in the ocean. And and I always find it, it's just, I'm just not saying that because it's a matter of perspective. But, you know, if we don't look at the other side of things, which is what we normally look from the inside of the hacking community, it's you miss the big picture, and you miss all the good that the hacking community is doing for the society. So as we like to call hackers, the good hackers, hackers, and everybody is a hacker, we use the term cyber criminal. And I feel like, in a way, I kind of see the same thing for journalism. Well, if you're just following the clickbait, you're kind of missing the point of being a good journalist, an ethical journalist. So there is always two faces of things. And Jack, you're in the community. You know, I think, what I mean.
Yeah, sure. You know, anytime somebody asks me about like the, because there's two pieces to this, right? One, you have very well-meaning journalists who are not necessarily chasing the clickbait, who just have bad sources. And by bad sources, I mean sources that might otherwise be reliable, well-spoken, et cetera, who are talking about stuff that they're just unqualified to speak about, right? And then of course we have the others that are just direct chase and clickbait. But I do see a lot of that kind of kicking around. And I think SolarWinds was such a great example of this because it was such a big story with so many, to Jeff's point, with so many moving parts, right? That, and so many potential ramifications, so many people came in to talk about it. And anytime a scenario like that happens, I'm reminded of the old quote that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. And what we end up with there is this, like, for instance, I believe it was New York Times was basically or promoted over the weekend that, you know, they had government sources saying that 1,000 developers had been, I take it back, it wasn't over the weekend, it was last Thursday, I believe it broke, that 1,000 Russian software engineers had been involved in the SolarWinds breach. And there's no chance that that was the case. Now, I'm not saying that New York Times didn't hear that from someone in the US government, right? But I will say for sure that had they picked up the phone to any qualified expert anywhere outside of government, nobody would have assessed that. For that matter, I'm not even positive that SolarWinds has 1,000 software engineers working on the Orion product. It would surprise me greatly if they have more than 100, right? And so this idea of, and I just use that as a straw man, by the way, I'm not like, you know, dropping on the New York Times, just saying like as a straw man, this is something that is, you know, I have no doubt that there's no question in my mind, no reporter just made that up. They went to somebody who may definitely, let's say this, not an expert in that specific portion of the, you know, of the field there. And again, we're going to spend, I am positive that I have not heard the last of that. JetBrains is another one that kind of came in on the SolarWinds side, right? And you know, I had several folks referring to that quote as, I hate that it's New York Times. Again, they're going to think I'm hammering on them, but they called it the New York Times denial of service, right? And so there are real world implications here, right? When we get, you know, or when the media gets the stories wrong, but for whatever it's worth, again, I trust the sourcing. I know the reporters involved and, you know, at least on the JetBrains side, I trust that they were told that. I have no doubt. It's just bad sourcing or maybe unqualified sources or whatever the right word is there does have a real impact in the cybersecurity community.
Jeff, any thoughts on that?
It's really interesting. And to put the journalist's side on that, there's a certain amount of just what would you call it, realpolitik or prosaic background to this. Like, so for example, I know there's been breaches that have happened that are big, but escaped coverage because the person, the cybersecurity expert, wasn't on duty that day at that particular broadcast or whatever. It can be as simple as that. You know, your company could be popped, but you avoid a headline because at that time, you know, none of the experts were at work that day. So, you know, it could be that the journalist who got that line about, you know, 1,000 hackers had to work, 1,000 coders had to work on it. It could be that they were somebody who wasn't particularly expert in this, but got put on it and told, you know, find a line, just get a line on this, keep phoning people and you get a line on it. So, and it's not good. I'm not, you know, justifying that aspect, but it's possible to sort of overestimate the ability of newsrooms to always have journalists who kind of know what they're talking about. But the other thing is, you know, the editors further up the chain, I don't know, if I was an editor listening to that, I'd be like, that sounds a bit outlandish. And by the way, can't we get a better line than that? But at a certain point, you know, you have to put the story to bed, you have to publish something. And if that's the best line you got, that could be the one you go with. But if one thing I would say, Jake, if that was unsourced, that particular assertion, as a journalist, I'd be like, no, if you're going to feed me that line, you put your name behind it so that if somebody reads it, they can at least say who told me it.
Well, yeah, totally. And I think that's another thing that's rather important, right? And again, given my intelligence background, I entirely understand why people need to be off the record for stuff and why people need to be on background for stuff. And I get that. And yet at the same time, I really now am parsing through, you know, media stories. And you know, I do a good amount of work where I'm doing effectively threat intelligence where that involves breaking down what's in the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg or insert media publication here for executives, for the where's the there, right? What do I need to do as a result of this? And I'll tell you that I place dramatically higher credence in things that are sourced with a name behind it than the stuff that's not. And it's a routine that I'm coming back to. And I'm like, this is an unnamed source somewhere. I know the reporter, so they wouldn't have gone without a second unnamed source backing that. But two unnamed sources may have heard from the same, and we've seen this before, may have heard the same incorrect information from the same source of truth. It reminds me of that episode of The Office, the US version, excuse me here, but the US version where there's a bunch of rumors going around and they trace it all back to one guy, right? And it's like, yep. So even though you would have had multiple independent sources, right? You know, again, they would have all heard the rumors from the same place. And so it's still possible to get wrong. Jeff, too, yeah. Man, without a name behind it.
Oh, yeah. We had, and this comes back to, you know, the point about journalists having their strings pulled. You know, we had, there was a very febrile period. Actually, there's been many febrile periods, but with the Brexit negotiations in the UK, you know, there were papers that were just running all sorts of stuff. And you knew full well it was somebody in government or maybe somebody in the opposition just putting a line out, giving it to a journalist and thinking, oh, we'll put that in the paper and we'll see if they run it and then we'll see what people say. And I just, in the end, I was like, no, if you've not got a source, I'm just disregarding the story now, because journalists are effectively then being just used for somebody else's. Where's our independence? How can we turn around to the public and justify our existence if all we are is a mouthpiece for somebody who's like, yeah, print this, and they just tell you something, you just print it. That's, yeah. And Jake's point is exactly that. You know, that's Jake's reaction to some of these stories is exactly what I'm worried about as a journalist. If we don't get it right, we lose the respect of people like him, and that's bad. You know, you're not going to talk to journalists necessarily if that keeps going that way.
I think that's an excellent point, because Jeff, at the beginning, you said that journalists and let's call it newspaper or any sort of information is not what it used to be. Meaning, you know, I guess you meant we have the competition of the social media where everybody all of a sudden become a journalist, become a influencer, become, you know, has an audience. So in a way, I feel like maybe, unfortunately, there may be a little less power, but there's definitely a lot more responsibility to be the guardians of the truth, the guardians of doing the moral, the right thing to do. So my question here is, do you see, based on your experience, and this is probably a question for both, a better way to work together for this type of topics?
I'll happily start and then kick it to Jeff here, but
yes,
I,
please.
For whatever it's worth, so I think to your point, right, there are a lot of influencers or whatever we're going to call them out there with large audiences and different, you know, social media platforms that wouldn't be considered traditional journalists and yet are indeed publishing information, right? And I've seen, particularly over the last couple of years here, again, you know, kind of looking at that time horizon, the last 2 to 3 years, I've seen a lot of journalists that are literally just picking up tweets from people, embedding those in a story and literally writing narrative around a few different tweets and just going with it. I'm not saying that's good, bad, or indifferent, right? But it definitely is when these people have, you know, weird random names, for instance, right? And, you know, it's their persona behind that is not known or any, I'm not knocking the hacker handle thing, you do you, right? But if your persona is not known, that's just as bad as an anonymous source at that point from a credibility standpoint. And I don't know. I mean, I guess they're to some greater or lesser extent, I think you're onto something there, Marco, you know, about needing some kind of, you know, I generally then will go refer back to, you know, the articles that are written in the reliable publications, right? So BBC, ZDNet, you name it, rather than, you know, the original tweets. But knowing that, again, a lot of this is being very, I know that there's a race to get it done, right? And at the same time, like, race to be relevant. At the same time, it is, yeah, I think there is a responsibility to the press, speaking not as a member of the press, but I would very much like the press to take on that responsibility of almost arbiters of truth, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, the you know, I was working for an internet company during the dot-com boom, and there was this idea that, you know, the traditional gatekeepers were crashing down, and, you know, the BBCs of this world and the Daily Mails of this world and the Guardians of this world, you know, your days are numbered and News Now will take over. And what I find interesting is the pendulum has, you know, to a certain extent swung back, you know. As we've had the proliferation of outlets, the more shouting and the more noise there is, the more people look for signal in that noise. And they are starting to come back to, as Jake's just mentioned, the BBCs, the ZDNets, who are, you know, old school, not so old school in ZDNet's case, but, you know, older school, you know, media companies that have got a lot of skin in the game, that are hiring professional journalists, that have shareholders and editorial boards, and, you know, that you can trust more than you can trust a lot of the other sources. So I think, you know, sort of quite, I'm quite pleased by that in a way, in that, you know, that's, that seems to be a good thing. In terms of working, you know, your question, Marco, about, you know, working together, I get, this is totally self-interested, but for me, this is why I got into investigative journalism, is your only way I find of fighting this stuff is to get deeper into the story, to uncover more of it, to unwrap the entire thing. And if there's one plea I'd make to you know, to the tech community, it's to work sort of patiently with journalists, if you find good ones, to really get behind and unwrap the story. You know, if you're if the journalist is chasing a quick and immediate headline, that's bad. If the security researcher is chasing a quick and immediate headline, I also think that's bad, because, as I say, we need to explain what's behind the monsters. We need to be the Jeff Goldblum, you know, person in the drama. And that takes time. We have to understand this stuff, unwrap this stuff, do a lot of chasing, do a lot of investigation. So, you know, I feel like a deeper, longer, to use a phrase, a deeper, longer relationship between techies and journalists is going to be rewarding. But look, that's not going to happen for everybody, for every techie, for every journalist. So, but it's I just feel it's a service to the public that we need to do. And you know, journalists can only do it together with techies.
Yeah, and Jeff, I want to stick with you, and perhaps Jake has some thoughts on this as well, because what we're talking about here is tons of noise, right? And how do you find the nuggets through the noise? And perhaps publications like you're describing are places to bring some of that noise together in a way that presents it to somebody who cares about that topic. And with that, we have to bring some transparency, certainly some level of trust. But what I want to hear from you, Jeff, is when we're talking to businesses, we often say the security team needs to understand the role of business or their role in business. Mm. And certainly as a journalist, we have to connect the elements of the story to the reader of the story. So it's almost the connection of the hacker, the researcher, to somebody that cares. So how do we bridge that gap between all the stuff the hackers bring to the conversation in a way that builds that trust, maintains transparency? We have that connection to who's behind the mask, if you will, mm-hmm. in terms of the story that's being told.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you know, use the word story, and we bandy that phrase around. I think it's really worth concentrating on that word story, because stories have certain things about them. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they generally have people in them. And we generally know in the story who the good people are and who the bad people are, although we also have characters like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, who, you know, is this intriguing sort of middle character who's hops from one to the other. So, you know, look, if you're interested in working with journalists, and you've got to think about what a story means. And so you've got to think, okay, where's this story start? What's the beginning? What's the middle? What's the end? Did we, you know, get a result? Did this person get shut down? Do we know, you know, did this hacker get arrested in the end? You know, so what are the sort of components of the story? That's how you keep the audience interested. And what has been useful over the past few years is we've had an increasing focus on attribution, which has been helpful, to the point where, in, you know, some cases, notably the sort of North Korean government hackers, you know, we've had the FBI actually naming and putting a photo out of the individual. That really helps. I hate to say it, but having a face that the public can say, that's the guy, and it usually is a guy, you know, that is helpful. What we've also had is a slight change in how people feel about victims of these crimes. You know, there was this huge sense of cyber shame, the idea that you never get caught with a hack, you never admit it. And among the general public as well, you know, a lot of people are shamed by the fact they got hacked, they got phished. I think that started to change a bit, not massively, but started to change a bit, which means, again, we can say, look, this person suffered, this person lost money. Here's the guy who runs the company, and he's had to lay some people off, or he's fighting to recover the money that he or she lost, you know, with his company. So, you know, increasingly we're getting people and characters that we can use to tell these stories. So I think that's how we reconnect with the public. And again, you know, for techies, techies all about the how. And I love that. It's an intriguing thing. But imagine your house got burgled and somebody went on and on about how the lock got broken. And you're like, well, who robbed me? Who burgled my house? And the person's like, no, look at the lock. Look at how the lock got broken. And you're like, I don't care how the lock got broken. Tell me who robbed my house. That's the conversation I think we're in. We, you know, tech folks need to kind of appreciate that for us as journalists to tell the story, we need to work on a bigger canvas and a bigger landscape, and it's going to take a bit more time and not necessarily have all the techie components in it that you would want to see. But that, you know, as journalists, we have a slightly different job. Not sure that answers your question, but anyway, that's the answer.
Absolutely does. And Jake, your view, a hacker's role in telling that story, more than just a soundbite, right?
No, I think that's it, right? And we in our community do a ridiculously bad job of this, right? We focus on the minutiae, to Jeff's point, right, of the lock, without getting to the what's the meat? Why does it matter, right?
Yeah.
If you're looking to be better at this, couple of things right off the bat. Go watch Sammy Kamkar. He has a fantastic presentation. I mean, he does fantastic presentations in general, but has a fantastic presentation from a number of years ago called How I Met Your Girlfriend that he presented at DEF CON. And I want to be very clear here, this has not aged well from a, you know, a politically correct, what have you, kind of has a real stalkery vibe to it, right? So, you know, content warning, whatever. But what Sammy does in that talk is he takes this very obscure cryptographic vulnerability and shows how it can actually be used to deliver real impact, mm-hmm. right? Because how many folks even understand what a pseudo random number generator is, and why a small weakness in one and a slight, issue with entropy is actually going to impact real? This is like esoteric math stuff, even for a lot of comp sci geeks, right? And so then translating that to the public, like, how do you get that story told? Again, we as hackers, right, need to get better. Security professionals need to get better at being able to really lay out that impact, lay out the so what, because if you're relying on the journalists to do it, right, and trying to come up with that, then, you know, again, you can't be shocked when they, you know, if they get it wrong, right? It's just that's, you know, you're taking very minutia and they're trying to tell a story, and there's going to be something lost in translation. If you can just translate it in the first place, and lay it out in human terms, right, instead of computer terms, man, what a better world.
Yeah, yeah. But it's just to come to Jake's point, there's a level of trust there. You know, I work with tech companies, and we have this point now where they know that at some point I'm going to turn around to them and say, sorry, I'm not going to include that bit. It's just too obscure. It's the crux of it, the crux of it. And I say to them, nope, sorry, public is not going to be interested. But you've got to be honest about that and get that level of trust. And they still talk to me, so that's at least good.
Well, I'm kind of sad to interrupt this conversation. We have a hard stop, and I'm taking notes, and we're talking about tech. We're talking about telling stories. Pretty much it's Christmas morning for me. So, but I do see the point of this need to work together. I mean, everybody has a job. Everybody has a role. We can't expect the journalists to be the best hacker or the best tech talker. And we cannot expect the best hacker to be, or cybersecurity researcher to be, the best storyteller. So I think this is the proof, and I'm going to kind of tie the end together here, of the need to work together with trust and transparency, and don't rush the news out there. And I think that's what society needs right now, to really understand what's going on, and not just a click, share, a retweet, and then another retweet, and then another retweet, without having no absolutely idea about what that article actually talks about. So, Sean, thank you for inviting me. I really enjoy.
Yeah, this is good. And hats off to Jeff for surfacing this, and very much appreciate Jake joining us as well. Great to get dual perspectives here coming together. Hopefully, more stories with words that matter, with trust and transparency at the core. So thank you both for a great conversation.
Have a good one.
Thanks both. Really good to speak to you, and really good to meet you, albeit virtually.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.